Focus, right here.
Let's have a little drink.
Yumi.
Always. Yumi.
All of you wives.
With you all the time.
We men, we ask a lot.
Can't you see?
We ask for strength.
To be
food at home, a house clean.
With you all the time.
And discretion above all else.
Boys and their toys. At least we know they're getting work done.
Welcome to the Victory Project.
We're all here because we believe in the mission.
What are we doing?
Changing the world.
What are we doing?
Changing the world.
That's right.
What do you think they're really doing out there?
What do you mean?
The one thing they ask of us is to stay here. Where it's safe.
Do you even know what the Victory Project actually is? Have you ever asked?
Do you?
Please. What's actually happening?
Stop it, Alice.
What if this place is dangerous? What if...
Stop it!
No. Jack. It's okay. I'm curious to hear where she's going with this.
I need you to listen to me. They're lying about everything.
We are not going backwards. We're pushing forward.
Everyone is acting like I'm crazy. And I'm not crazy.
Our life together. We could lose this.
I don't trust him.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and happy Hallows Eve at the time of this recording, and welcome back to another episode of the newly rebranded Warehouse Podcast, now known as The Watch List. We express our gratitude to our friend Danielle for inspiring the new title and a more accurate representation of the goal of this podcast. We brainstormed this over a few glasses of espresso martinis at a cafe in Los Feliz here in LA, so it was not intentional, but it was a serendipitous little accident, I should say. So, yes, if you see the title change on your Amazon Music playlist in the next couple of days, it is because we found a title that we're happy with. I am your hostess with the mostest, Aaron Escobar, presenting this pre-recorded and edited episode from sunny Culver City, California. Well, right now, at the time of this recording, it's about 9 o'clock at night on a Monday, right before Halloween, and it is a full moon outside. And it is the third birthday of our lovely kitty girl, Luna Escobar. So happy birthday to her. She's somewhere hiding around the apartment. We shall see if she makes an appearance this episode. Culver City, famously known as the heart of Screenland, as our city motto proudly states, which I did not notice until a couple of days ago when I was walking to get a coffee. And I saw around our trees in downtown Culver, it says the heart of Screenland. So I kind of figured I would start saying Culver City, the heart of Screenland, because I am proud of this part of town. I love my city. Culver City is magical. We have Amazon, Warner Brothers, Apple TV, Hulu's moving out here, Sony Pictures, Sony Pictures Animation, Sony Video Games. So many studios have had set up shop here over the past 100 years or are moving out here. MGM formerly the MGM lot is out here now. Now it's just known as the Culver lot. That is where The Wizard of Oz was shot. And that is also where Gone with the Wind was filmed as well. In fact, it is the mansion from Gone with the Wind. So when you see that swooping end and you see the mansion in the background and all of that, that is the Culver Studio. We also have one of the first 5-star hotels in Los Angeles outside of downtown in the Culver Hotel, which supposedly housed Charlie Chaplin, Marilyn Monroe, half of the cast of The Wizard of Oz, apparently the Munchkins threw, you know, wicked parties there in the 30s. I'm not sure if that's substantiated or not. It is truly a magnificent hotel. I highly recommend people go and check it out if you can, if you're in the neighborhood. It is celebrating its 100th anniversary next year in 2024, so you bet your sweet bippy I will be there, parting away like it's the 1920s. So Culver City is a bustling hub of entertainment, has a rich history steeped in the golden era of Hollywood, making it the perfect backdrop for discussing cinematic adventures. As we settle into today's exploration, we eagerly unpack Olivia Wilde's latest directorial venture, Don't Worry, Darling, set against the backdrop of the 1950s, a virtual reality dystopian nightmare juxtaposed with an incel dream come true. This sophomore outing by Wilde, although exhibiting moments of narrative clunkiness, still manages to intrigue audiences with its thematic depth and visual allure. I am a fan of postmodern architecture and California ranch style architecture. Palm Springs is kind of my mecca for me for that reason. I intend to drive up there in a nice Ford Thunderbird from the 1950s or 60s, decked out in a wonderful poodle skirt if I can, and just, you know, snap some photos of Palm Springs. I think it would be wonderful. I love the aesthetics of the 50s and 60s, even if the societal structures of the 50s and 60s were pretty much garbage. I work very hard to have a 50s aesthetic in my apartment. It's not cheap by any means, but there are elements that I have that are clearly inspired by 50s design. You know, I have a huge record collection. I have Googie chairs. I have sort of postmodern or postmodern inspired furniture. I try my best to do it. It is not easy. It is a very expensive hobby, but it is the aesthetic that I gravitate towards the most. Even if, again, I highly disagree and rightfully so, despise the culture of the 50s. After all, it was the culture in which women were the most oppressed. Is also the era in which we had the Red Scare and McCarthyism, and the largest amount of censorship to ever hit Hollywood was in the 50s, second to maybe the 30s, but the 50s primarily is pretty infamous for the blacklist, the creation of the blacklist in Hollywood, with Dalton Trumbo probably being the most iconic blacklisted filmmaker of that era. I am very proud that we have reclaimed the blacklist. So that is my take very briefly on the 1950s aesthetic and social issues, but we will dive deep into that a little bit further into the episode. The film captivates through its compelling storyline and remarkable performances, threading together a unique blend of social commentary and retro-futuristic aesthetics, which is true. I do feel like this film is in the vein of, I suppose it's in the vein of Fallout in terms of its retrofuturism. The interior of the virtual reality of the 50s of Victory is not obviously retrofuturistic, but there is an element that is slightly unsettling because there are a few anachronisms in terms of costume design, of vehicles, of a few set props that kind of weren't a thing in the 50s. I think in one scene, you can see a modern dishwasher, which, yes, they had dishwashers in the 50s, but they didn't have a digital display dishwasher, which I caught like the third time I saw it. And I was like, oh, I can kind of let that go in this regards because it could be seen as a sort of glitch or error in the virtual reality that Victory has created, that like not everything in this virtual reality is historically accurate, which it's a clunky excuse for not necessarily bad filmmaking, but poor attention to detail. I think other directors probably would have caught on to that, but we will again get into some of the issues that I have with this film a little later on. Don't Worry, Darling challenges social norms while immersing viewers in a meticulously crafted world that explores the hauntingly plausible fusion of the past and a speculative future. Wilde's bold directorial choices and casting gripping portrays creates a viewing experience that prompts contemplation and discussion. Join us as we dive into the nuances of this cinematic offering, discussing its successes and missed opportunities, and ultimately providing our listeners with an in-depth analysis of this thought-provoking addition to the world of cinema. Welcome to The Watch List, where we sift through the vast array of films, guiding you to discover the hidden gems and unmissed experiences in the realm of storytelling and visual artistry. Hosted by me, Aaron Escobar. By the way, I promised myself I would cut back on I've been going a little hard this weekend. I've been drinking like a lot Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. Cause it's the weekend before Halloween. It's the only time I get to celebrate because I will be at the film festival, American Film Market, Tuesday through about Friday, which of course I'm probably gonna have at least like a bunch of drinks and coffee and all of that good stuff. But I made a promise to myself that I would not drink tonight. However, after the day that I had with dealing with emails and scheduling and planning out our screening for tomorrow, I am a development coordinator. For those of you that don't know, that's how I pay the bills. That's how I pay the rent. Even though I still have a student loan and bills left over from COVID that I'm trying to work through, it is what pays the bills. It is what pays the rent. It is what allows me to have a decently charmed life. I could always use a little bit more money. Everyone can right now, and inflation sucks. But my day-to-day is development coordinator. I've been a development coordinator. I've been working in the development sphere for a little over, almost 2 years now at this point. So it's been my career for a while. I originally worked in film sales. So now I transitioned from film sales along with transitioning in another regards. And after the day that I had today of just running around since like 7 o'clock in the morning, I needed a drink. So today's drink is a gin and tonic and a nice little martini glass because I am discussing a film that is trying to replicate the 1950s. And that is pretty much my whole vibe with my existence. So I might as well have a nice gin and tonic and a nice martini glass. So come join us as we discuss the cast of Don't Worry, Darling, starring, of course, Florence Pugh as Alice, who I absolutely love. And of course, she is our go-to final girl for the 21st century. Actually, you know, take that back. I think it's either tossed between either Florence Pugh, Dakota Johnson, or Mia Goth. I think those would be my top three final girls for the 2020s. Who knows? We're only halfway through the decade. Harry Styles as Jack, which I actually kind of like Harry Styles' music outside of One Direction now. Music for a sushi restaurant is actually kind of an interesting track. He's a little bit more experimental outside of One Direction. And in terms of an actor, he is absolutely miscast in this role. He's dealing with Florence Pugh, Olivia Wilde, Gemma Chan, Chris Pine, who is phenomenal, and I really think is an incredibly underrated actor. He reminds me of Marlon Brando in terms of his disdain for the film industry and Hollywood in general, which I respect. I disdain Hollywood. I disdain the film industry. There are aspects that I love about it, but there are aspects that I hate, and the aspects that I hate greatly outweigh the aspects that I love about it. And so I kind of get why Chris Pine kind of distance himself in terms of his presentation for in the Hollywood system. But, you know, I understand. I think Harry Styles isn't necessarily a bad actor. It's just, if he wanted to make a foray into acting, this was not the film for him to do it. This is a mainstream Hollywood film that was trying to be elevated horror. He kind of brought it down because he is not at the level to act alongside Florence Pugh, which is the key issue. Florence Pugh is so magnificent in what she does and is such a brilliant actress that you need an actor that can match her in that way. And Harry Styles you know, going above and beyond, I'm not really going to dive deep into sort of the gossip of this film, because frankly, my take on that, and, you know, Olivia Wilde also has a role in it as Bunny, which is Florence Pugh's character, Alice's friend. And a lot of the hatred thrown towards Wilde for her behavior on set, yes, her behavior on set was not justifiable by any means, and yeah, is still pretty atrocious in terms of professionalism on a film set. But, you know, her divorcing her husband and then having a minor fling or an affair with one of her lead actors, that's the kind of stuff male directors have been doing for the better part of a century. Steven Spielberg met his wife on the set of Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom. Christopher Nolan's producing partner is his wife, and he met her on the set of Following. So, you know, that whole, oh, she hooked up with someone on set and that's just unprofessional. My view on that, and this is probably the only in-depth conversation I'm going to have about the behind-the-scenes gossip of this film, because I really don't care. I do not read TMZ. Is that women in this industry, and this is coming from a woman in this industry, are held to ridiculously high standards in terms of how we should behave, in terms of how we should act, in terms of what we're allowed to do and say and behave on camera and behind the scenes, or even in an office environment. And the standards are so high that we are never going to please anyone. Someone is going to get mad at us. Some two-bit hack journalist is going to write an unsavory article about us in IndieWire or TMZ or Deadline. And that's just the nature of the beast, and there's nothing you can do to stop it. So the only way to stop it is to just not give a shit about them. And as much as I can say Olivia's attitude on set and behavior on set might have been unprofessional, the fact of the matter is, I wasn't on set, so I don't know. But I can say the way she responded to that by just ignoring it, it's probably the best attitude towards that. Because again, she could do anything and we will still get flack and hate and animosity and jealousy thrown our way. It's just what happens when you're a woman in a predominantly male-dominated industry. And the only way to win that game is not to play it, because if you play it, you're just going to be bogged down in austerity politics and pity politics and, you know, identity politics. And that's just a waste of time, because it prevents you from actually doing what you want to do, which is creating new and interesting film and TV shows and content. So for better or worse, as much as I can say Olivia's performance on set was probably not professional, that's a lot of the conflict she had with Florence, her attitude towards the general reaction from the paparazzi is pretty on course for how we should treat those situations. And that is just utter disdain and just ignore them, because there's nothing we can do at the end of the day. And going on from that, it also stars the lovely Gemma Chan, who I think is phenomenal. I want to see more of her. She is in the Marvel. She's from the Humans as well. If you don't remember her character, she is a wonderful woman. She has this beautiful British accent, and I have a thing for British accents. And she's wonderful in this performance. I wish she had a bigger role, but she, I think she carries it well, and she does a lot for what she has. She only has maybe, you know, 10, 15 minutes of screen time in total. But the moment she's on screen, she just steals the show. And I always admire that. I think she's probably one of the rising character actors of her generation. Hopefully she elevates to more than just a character actress. If not, you know, she's eking out a wonderful living as a character actress in these kinds of films. And I absolutely enjoy that. Kiki Lane as Margaret, Sydney Chandler as Wyatt, Nikki Kroll as Dean, and Chris Pine as Frank, and the delivery of how he says good girl in this film could be looped for about an hour as an ASMR video, and I will absolutely listen to that at night, because it's just so, that man makes me feel funny when he says that line, is all I'm going to say. I love Chris Pine. This movie made me fall in love with him. His name is Daddy to me now, because he's just He's just handsome, and the way he delivers his performance is so sinister and so weird and creepy. But the way he delivers that line, like a good girl, when he's talking to Florence Pugh, is just makes me feel funny all over. Asif Ali as Peter, Kate Burnett as Peg, Timothy Simmons as Dr. Collins, Douglas Smith as Bill, Ariel Stachler as Ted, Dee Dee Von Teese as herself, which it took me, like, I think 4 viewings. It wasn't until the most recent viewing that I actually caught on to the fact that the burlesque dancer at, like, the cha-cha club they go to was Dee Dee Von Teese. And I was like, oh, cool, Dee Dee Von Teese. Like, I wish I looked like her. I wish I had a better personality than her, which I think I do. But, hey, she brought back neo-burlesque, so at least she did something right with her career. I won't hold that one against her. But Alice and Jack Chambers are married, living in Victory, California, an idealistic 1950s desert company town. Every day the men leave for work at Victory headquarters in the surrounding desert, where their wives are discouraged from entering or even asking about. The women enjoy luxuries and lounging as housewives while the men are out. Alice spends her days with other wives, including her best friend, Bunny. Estranged resident Margaret, so, since having a mental breakdown after a desert visit resulted in her son's apparent death, claimed Victory took him as punishment for breaking the rules. At a party hosted by Victory's enigmatic founder, Frank, played by Chris Pine, of course, Alice witnessed Margaret's husband's attempt to medicate her, an effort to curb an outburst. While riding the trolley, Alice sees a plane crash in the desert, so rushes to help. She stumbles onto the headquarters and touches one of the mirror-like windows, experiencing surreal hallucinations about another life before waking up at home that night. Alice continues to experience increasingly strange occurrences, then receives a phone call from Margaret, who claims to have seen the same things. After brushing her off, she witnesses her slit her own throat and fall to her death. Before she can reach Margaret's body, Alice is dragged away by men in red jumpsuits who work for Frank. Jack dismisses Alice's claims and says Margaret is simply recovering from a household accident. When Alice asks him what is really happening at the Victory Project, he becomes angry and gaslights her. The town's physician, Dr. Collins, prescribes Alice medication, which Jack declines, and she steals Margaret's heavily redacted medical file from his briefcase before burning it. Becoming increasingly paranoid during a company celebration where Frank promotes Jack, Alice breaks down in the bathroom. Confronted by Bunny, she attempts to explain her suspicions. Bunny reacts angrily when Alice tells her she went to headquarters, accusing her of jeopardizing the livelihood in Victory. Alice and Jack invite their neighbors to dinner, including Frank and his wife, Shelley. Frank privately confronts her suspicions and taunts her to challenge him. Spurred on, Alice attempts to expose him over dinner, but he makes her appear delusional to the others, causing Jack grief over her supposed mental deterioration. Afterward, Jack again won't listen when Alice talks of Frank or Victory's wrongdoings. She begs him to leave, to which he feigns agreement, but instead lets Frank's men take her away. Dr. Collins gives Alice electric shock therapy, during which she sees flashes of herself in the 21st century, struggling to get by as a surgical resident, Alice Warren, and living in the unemployed, lazy Jack, who spends like half his time just watching pseudo-intellectual YouTube videos hosted by Frank, who is so clearly parodying Jordan Peterson or Joe Rogan or Ben Shapiro. Like, it's a clear, not-so-subtle nod that Jack is basically an incel. Which I find absolutely hilarious. I feel like that story motif probably could have been handled a little bit better, but I do kind of find it quite funny that his character in the 21st century basically spends all his time on Reddit and on YouTube in, like, incel forums. And yeah, like, hence the reason why I say an incel wet dream, because it is basically every incel's wet dream to drug a woman, shut her up, tie her up, put her into a virtual reality and have his way with her. Consequence-free, as it were, because it's essentially how they see us. We are essentially sex objects, and, you know, the sad thing is there are a lot of trad wife women out there that feel like the only way they can find happiness or validation from a man is to be a sex object. There are people out there that are happy to have literally, you know, demeaned themselves to being nothing more than fuck dolls. And there's more to life than that. Our validation as women does not come from the mouth of a man. You know, I'm very happy I was raised by a single mother who always told me never rely on a man. And rightfully so, because that is no way to live. And I do find it funny that this film, it's a very thin commentary on like the MGTOW mancer incel culture, whatever the hell you want to call it. But it is there. I feel like that could have been explored a little bit more. Again, we'll go into that further on in the episode. But I do feel like that incel aspect, that mansphere, MGTOW, whatever you want to call it again, could have been explored just a tad bit further, because there is some interesting elements there that I think would have made for compelling social commentary. But it's only touched upon, and it never really goes back to that story point. And I find it really interesting that there is an aspect that is there, but it never is fully explored. Like, for example, it's revealed that Bunny, Olivia Wilde's character, willingly chose to have herself put into the VR reality so she can sort of experience motherhood again after losing her children in the real world, which goes back to what I said just a few seconds ago about how some women willingly demean themselves by being just sex objects or trad wifey on like TikTok or YouTube, which is just disgusting to me. Like, listen, I love cooking dinner. I love baking cookies. I love wearing 1950s house dresses. I am more than that, though. I am a Rosie the Riveter feminist. Come on. But I do find that interesting that there are those two aspects of trad culture that I think is mostly just mockery now. I really don't think most people do that or believe in that outside of certain circles in our country and outside of certain evangelical circles in this country. And the truth of the matter is that kind of 1950s bewitched, I Love Lucy, Leave It to Beaver, idealized suburban environment never really existed. And when it did exist in the 50s at the height of it, it was only for a select few people in this country, predominantly upper middle class to upper class aristocratic waspy Americans. If you're Black, a person of color, working class, white, or anyone else in this country, you did not have that existence. That existence was just a microcosm for a very select, you could either say fortunate or disfortunate, depends on how you know, they're either fortunate or unfortunate, depends on how you view that sort of concept of Americana, had that existence. Not everyone lived in the suburbs. Not everyone was part of a housing association, right? Not everyone is part of the 1950s aesthetic. That aesthetic is idealized. It's idealized now. It barely existed when it did exist, and only for a select group of people. And, you know, that period quickly vanished by the mid-60s to 70s. So I do find it interesting that even now, even that sort of environment of the 1950s, of the trad wife, of the housewife, a single breadwinner with a wife at home and the kids, that's not a possibility now for various reasons. And it sure as hell was hardly a possibility in the 50s. Yeah, sure, houses probably would have been cheap, but we're talking about an era when the average take-home salary for 2 weeks worth of work was probably $100, you know, and you were paying maybe $10 in expenses. But that environment was only for a select group of people. And even then, that environment was incredibly toxic to the women and to the men, because people felt forced to be in that environment. You know, a lot of couples were in marriages of convenience or comfort or familiarity. It wasn't really because it was the standard. It was just something more or less forced on them. And even then, that era of the nuclear family, you know, the son and the daughter and the mom and the dad, that only existed really in the 50s. Prior to that, family structures were entirely different. when America was founded at the beginning of this country, beginning in the, you know, 19th to 20th century, it was necessary to have a lot of kids on a farm because those kids were your free labor. And not all of them were going to live. So it was quite common to have 5 or 6 kids. And that idea of only having 2 kids and the white picket fence and the house and the car and the wife and the husband, that is a very recent concept in terms of American family structure. And I find it quite hilarious that that somehow seems to be the common structure we all towards tend to gravitate towards. Some of us had nuclear families, some of us don't. I know more people than not that were born in a non-nuclear family than were. I was born in a very untraditional household, single mom with an older brother and me, the lone girl. And I mean, I guess you could say that was a borderline nuclear family, but it wasn't quite, right? And if it wasn't for the advantages of living in a pseudo post-feminist or pseudo post-third wave feminist decade of the 90s and mid 2000s, our lives would have been drastically different because my mom wouldn't have been allowed to own property or have a full-time job or have a bank account without a male co-signer. All of that came about in the 70s and 60s. So, you know, to get back, we'll get back to the plot shortly, but I find it very interesting, and this is a bit of a tangent, but I find it very interesting that the same group of people that promote this idealized white picket Americana, which is very WASPy and very evangelical Christian based, are still the evangelical Christian base in this country. And even then, that base would not be able to afford that lifestyle because most of them do not have the income or the benefits or the privileges of being in that very narrow bandwidth of social economic classes that can afford that lifestyle still. Only a very small fraction of that of this country could have it in the 50s, and an even smaller fraction of it can only have it now. And there are very certain, very specific requirements you needed back in the 50s, and those requirements still tend to be the case now. Like Anglo-Saxon Protestant, gotta love the WASPs. They have not died out, and God, I wish they were. After her treatment, Alice resumes her normal life, but comes to realize the visions are actually memories. Realizing he can no longer conceal it, Jack finally reveals the truth. Victory is a simulated world created by Frank, where he and the other men lead their visions of perfect lives. The women they have forced into the 50s simulation, unaware that the life exists outside of Victory, are fakes. When the men leave for work each day, they are actually leaving the simulation for real jobs to pay for their drugged wives to stay there. Jack argues that Alex was miserable in the real world, while Victory means they can both finally be happy. But she is livid. She's trapped where, without her consent. Jack begs Alice to stay, forcibly grabbing her, prompting her to smash a glass over his head, killing him in both the simulation and reality. Frank immediately hears of Jack's death, while Bunny finds Alice and admits she has always known of the simulation, but chooses to stay to be with her children, who died in real life. She says her real body will be killed by Frank's minions if she doesn't get to headquarters, the exit portal from the simulation. Alice silently confronts the neighborhood, leading the other wives to become aware, while the husbands panic. Filling in Jack's car, Alice is chased by Dr. Collins and Frank's men, maneuvering them into fatally crashing into each other. Meanwhile, Shelly fatally stabs Frank to take control of Victory. Arriving at headquarters, Alice has a final simulation vision of Jack, then puts her hands on headquarters as Frank's men reaches her. The screen cuts to black, and Alice gasps for air, implying that she escaped the simulation. How the hell she got out of her bonds is a little beyond me, but hey, I guess that's for part two. Development. The film was announced in August 2019 after a bidding war amongst 18 studios to acquire the next Olivia Wilde-directed project. New Line Cinema won the auction. The original spec script was written by brothers Cary and Shane Van Dyke. The screenplay appeared on the 2019 Blacklist. So, going back to what I said earlier, we have reclaimed the title Blacklist. It is now a title to be proud of and not one of shame. Katie Cyberman was brought on to do a rewrite, which became the film's screenplay. According to Wilde, the sinister character Frank was inspired by psychologist and author Jordan Peterson, whom she described as pseudo-intellectual hero to the incel community. Which, you know, I may not always agree with Olivia Wilde, and I do think she can be a bit of a problematic character, even though I'm a bit of an Olivia Wilde apologist. I can at least agree with her on that regards, because he is a pseudo-intellectual incel god king or god emperor, whatever you wish to call them. But I do find it funny that a lot of, again, it's surface detail. It doesn't really go into depth about the Mansphere and the MGTOW movement. It's there in the wings. It's there in the foreground. It's there in the shadows. But it isn't significantly explored in the film to the point where it's anything just a footnote, which I feel sorely disappointed in, because I think that aspect, that social commentary aspect, could have been very interesting. So, like, as of right now, right, the film is primarily a modern 21st century retelling of the Stepford Wives, which is one of my favorite films from the 70s. I actually think that film is probably due for a remake, and I would love to see maybe Greta Gerwig do that. I think she would do a phenomenal job. In fact, I think Greta Gerwig would have done a phenomenal job with this film, because the casting would have probably been so much better. The directorial style of it would have been drastically different. I think it would have still followed some of the main story beats, but I think Greta would have had a more in-depth analysis of that pseudo-intellectual sort of incel culture aspect of it, which Olivia only touched upon in her version. I think a Greta Gerwig directed version of this would have been a lot stronger in the areas in which this film is weakest in terms of themes, in terms of structure, and in terms of just performance by Harry Styles. First of all, I don't think Harry Styles would be in it. I think it would have been entirely someone else. But I think if it was in the hands of a more, I don't want to be mean, but Olivia's previous film before Don't Worry Darling was Booksmart. And Booksmart is an amazing film. I love it. It's a great coming of age, you know, post high school graduation comedy film. And it's wonderful. It works on all levels. It's funny. I can relate to it. But it is not this film, right? Booksmart is essentially a girl's version of Superbad. And that's fine. We need a girl's version of Superbad. But having said that, it's hard for her to make that jump from comedy to suspense thriller, and that is very apparent in just how this film is structured. And I feel like in the hands of a better director and a more experienced director, like, of course, the wonderful Greta Gerwig, who we've covered previously on this podcast, but Lady Bird, and we need to do Frances Ha. It would have been stronger in the areas in which it's the weakest right now. But that's just my two cents. You know, I think if we get a Greta Gerwig directed Stepford Wives, which I could absolutely see her doing, it's probably one of her favorite films, or maybe a Greta Gerwig directed remake of Rosemary's Baby, which I think would be very interesting, because I would really love to see Greta Gerwig do horror, which is something she hasn't done. Sorry, if you're hearing a meowing, it's my cat Miagua in the other room. But I feel like she would have been stronger in the areas in which Olivia's weakest at. Could be wrong. Maybe we'll see. Maybe we will get a Greta Gerwig film in the similar vein of Don't Worry, Darling. I would love to see that. I look forward to that, Greta, if you listen. I'm also from Sacramento. Feel free to hit me up. Let's talk. But yeah, I'm very much on the fence with this film. I like it. I know the plot holes in it. I know the faults in it. I'm aware of them, but also that still doesn't detract from my enjoyment of the film. The opening scene was filmed at the Kaufman House in Palm Springs. Principal photography began in Los Angeles on October 26, 2020. It was temporarily halted for 2 weeks on November 4th after a crew member tested positive for COVID-19, which resulted in stars Pew, Styles, and Pine being quarantined. Filming wrapped on February 13, 2021. According to film journalist Jordan Rumi, a producer alleged Matthew Lipidek directed portions of the film towards the end of production due to Wilde and then-boyfriend Styles' unexplained absences. The film's original score was composed by John Powell. Arian Phillips served as costume designer, which props to her or them for designing pretty period accurate costumes that I would love to wear. I have a thing for, again, 1950s housewife dresses and cocktail dresses because they're phenomenal and beautiful and wonderfully crafted and hug your body so well that I would absolutely love to own a piece from this film. And apparently this was the first film shot at the Kaufman House. Wilde was inspired by architecture and hung photographer on her wall while working on the script. She told Variety, to be there was huge. To direct the first shot there felt like this really auspicious beginning to this movie, which was this love letter not only to film, but to architecture, to design of to this era, which, yes, there is a bit of a love letter aspect to the 50s aesthetics. And again, it's an idealized simulation of the 50s, which I understand. And it is also an idealized love letter to the design of the 1950s and 60s, which, you know, space age, gooky architecture, postmodernism, the fashion, the cars, everything was just so well thought of, so bespoke, so beautiful. The music wasn't too bad either. I have a problem with the Hollywood of the 1950s because it was so boring. I only have a handful of favorite films from the 50s, and most of those are like Frank Capra pictures. Asphalt Jungle, for example, being the most beloved film of that era to me, at least, and maybe Treasure of the Sierra Madre as well. Frank Houston, it's Angelica Houston's father. But yes, the films of this era are not my favorite. I prefer the 60s and prefer the 40s, even prefer the 30s if we're going to go back far enough. But the 50s was so lackluster. It is the embodiment of the studio era. It is the height of the studio era, which rightfully came crashing down in the early 60s, which is sort of a repeat of history of what's going on now, I think. Other filming locations included the Cicada Club in downtown Los Angeles during their victory party sequence, in the Volcano House in Newberry Springs, which served as Victory headquarters and was once owned by TV host Puel Hauser. So, fun facts, a little behind-the-scenes trivia that I'm sure you didn't know about the making of this film. Hope you enjoy it. I love the architecture of this era. I need to take a Palm Springs photo trip because I just need to go visit Palm Springs and be a cute 1950s girl and drink from a martini glass. Ha 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 ha. Closing thoughts. So, despite my admiration for classic cinemas like the original Stepford Wives and Rosemary's Baby, films that undoubtedly may have had an influence on the creation and design of Don't Worry, Darling, because I do see a lot of that aesthetic in this film, I find that this particular film, despite harboring immense potential to serve as a peculiar commentary on the ongoing social struggles with gender norms and the concepts of the nuclear family, again, going back to the idea that the nuclear family was not the nuclear family even in the 50s, because a lot of families then, you know, dad might have died in the Korean War, or dad might have died in World War II, or, you know, mom still had to help be a breadwinner in some way, especially if you were in the more Midwestern areas of this country, the Rust Belt. You were still working class. You did not have the benefit of having only one parent in the job market. That wasn't the case in the 50s, and it sure as hell isn't the case now. How families manage to afford that now is just a mix of privilege, probably just debt consolidation, and just being very, very lucky in terms of what they're able to have as a career. Again, that kind of lifestyle was very narrow in the 50s, and it's even more narrow now. It's just a fact of life. That lifestyle was never a possibility in the 50s, and it's not a possibility for the vast majority of people in this country, nor should it be something we should aspire to. I don't think there's anything wrong with necessarily being a stay-at-home mom, if you so choose to. The benefit of, you know, actual feminism is that whatever a woman chooses to do with her body or her life or her career or lack thereof is entirely within her right to do that. It stops being okay when it's no longer an option to be anything but a housewife. If that is the only option you have on the table, then it is not, you know, then that is not an ideal situation. If you have the luxury to be a stay-at-home mom for 2 years while you raise your child, then that's great, and you should absolutely take that option if you have that option. If you don't, then there should be certain social structures put in place, like, you know, government-subsidized daycare or paid maternity leave that can help that. But the fact is, we don't have government-subsidized daycare, which I do think is something we should be investing in. And we don't have maternity leave. Hey, to any conservative that's listening or to any politician that's listening, if you want to raise the birth rate in this country, maybe invest in making it easier to have a child. Again, government subsidized birth care or daycare and paid maternity leave. That would solve the birth crisis in this country a lot. Also, maybe make it illegal for corporations to own land and houses and just sit on them for evaluations. That should also stop being a thing, too. There, see, I just totally fixed our economy. You can vote for me in 2024. Just write in Aaron Escobar on your ballot, put feminist bitch, and then just sip it in there. And then, yeah, I will be in the White House. We'll have a kegger. I will throw goth party synth nights in the West Wing. And yeah, we'll be fine. But I do find this to be a very peculiar commentary on the ongoing social struggles with gender norms and the concepts of the nuclear family. It stumbles in its execution. It's rather comical how, again, our modern world, shaped by late-stage capitalism, perpetuates an unrealistic idea, the traditional image of a family with a house, two cars, a white picket fence, and children, supported by a single income, oddly enough, always seems to be the dad. The irony lies in the fact that that very social structure championed by individuals like conservative alt-right conservatives are the very same people that destroyed the possibility of having that lifestyle. Conservatives both want us to be in the household and raise kids, but also make it virtually impossible to do that unless you are very privileged. And then they wonder why the birth rate in this country declines. It's a very simple, simple, simple equation. It's the cost of living, you idiots. And it's always been that. Again, in the 50s, a very small fraction of this country in the 50s had that luxury, and an even smaller fraction of it have it now. And I do think that is an aspect of this film that could have been explored, and it just wasn't, because the life that Alice has in the 21st century, it isn't terrible. It's not great. She is a working woman supporting a lazy sort of, you know, potato couch husband and probably someone she should have divorced a long time ago. But it is a fact of life that is sometimes the case. But the irony is Jack's character is a loser in real life. And it's more or less his fault. He doesn't really do anything to change anything, and he just decides to take an easy way out, which is force the idea of a traditional life on the woman he loves. But you can't even really call that love, because he's not giving her an option of anything but that. I think it's kind of interesting that Olivia Wilde's character Bunny is a woman that willingly chooses to go into the simulation. And in that regards, it's not as terrible as what happens to Alice, because Alice obviously has no choice. She was forced into that situation, into the simulation, into that virtual reality. And again, it goes back to what I said just a few seconds ago. Traditional feminism would state that if a woman wants to stay at home and raise her kids, then that's perfectly fine. But if that's the only option she is given, is to be a birthing machine and stay at home and raise the kids, then that's not fine. And that's sort of the reality that Alice is forced into, is that if she was given a choice to live in that virtual reality, it still would not be great, but at least it's a choice. And at the end of the day, sometimes having a choice is better than no choice at all, right? So I do find it kind of interesting that the character of Bunny is a woman that made that choice. Is it explored thoroughly and thoughtfully and in depth? No. And I find that to be the key issue with this film, is that it touches upon a lot of interesting social dynamics, a lot of commentaries on, again, the Manosphere, the MGTOW movement, a woman's right to choose to be a housewife or a stay-at-home mom. And it only touches on those issues on a surface detail, on a surface pass, and it's very superficial in how it handles them, and it doesn't go any further. I think what would have made this film more interesting is if it explored those themes a little bit more in depth. And I feel like this is a perfect film of great execution, but lost potential. There was so much potential in the film of this film, but it is sort of glossed over for the aesthetics and beauty and architecture and design of the 50s, which I get. I absolutely understand. I love that aesthetic of the 50s. I am in a 50s dreamcore horror, but aesthetics will only get you halfway, right? Blade Runner is all aesthetics, but there is so much substance in that film. There is so much beauty in that film. Every line hits, every scene matters, every dialogue is memorable. That film is endlessly quotable, but it is a film that is both form and function. It is both beautiful to look at, and it is both profound in what it deals with and what it means to be human. Not saying Don't Worry, Darling could have been the next Blade Runner, because it obviously isn't, but it could have followed that route of having a beautifully designed world and also having something very interesting to say. But it focuses far too heavily on its aesthetic and sort of loses itself in its 50s trad wife dream core pop aesthetics and its themes that I was dealing with that are the thesis of the film end up getting muddled and lost in the fray. And I find that to be my deepest criticism of this film, is that all the interesting things it's trying to say are lost in the shuffle. The reality is, such a world barely existed, if at all. Even before the 1950s, the era of falling and during World War II witnessed an influx of women entering the workforce to fill the industrial gaps left by men at war. This era saw the rise of women's sports teams like the Rockford Peaches. Shout out to A League of Their Own, which I need to cover. I actually do need to cover that film because it's one of my favorites, which if you were a girl growing up in the 90s and you watched A League of Their Own, I got news for you. You're either bisexual or a lesbian, and just come out and admit it already. And, you know, it had Rosie the Riveter in the 1940s, the Rockford Peaches, the American All-Girls Baseball League. We had profound pushes for women's liberation in the 1940s. And to have that stripped away, only to force those same women back into domestic roles through coercion, substance abuse, because, you know, barbiturates were a thing. And don't worry, darling. Just take your barbiturates and you'll be fine, and then drink this martini, and then you're going to go to your electric shock therapy afterwards. Or if you don't, we're just going to lobotomize you like Rosemary Kennedy. And social pressures. However, this concept was mainly relevant for, again, a narrow period between 1949 and roughly 1964, pretty much when the baby boomers died off, when it rolled into Gen X. That's when this sort of American suburbia life kind of dwindled and died off. It's still, of course, a thing. American suburbs are still a breeding ground for horrific alt-right nationalism and Christian fundamentalism, and are still hotbeds of racism and xenophobia. And yes, there are slow shifts in the demographic of home ownership and who's part of a housing owners association or homeowners association and who lives in American suburbs. But predominantly American suburbs, for the most part, are still mostly white. And, you know, the terrible thing is modern American suburbs are just kind of shitty. The home constructions are terrible. They're built out of stucco. Things fall apart. And yet somehow, you know, people sink hundreds of thousands of dollars into these homes expecting to make a return. And the property is just, it's just worthless. There's nothing there. Like, who wants to live in an American starter home? I'd rather shoot myself than live in one. And I've seen American starter homes. I have families that live in them, and they're god awful. They're disgusting. They're bland. They're generic. It's sort of like that song from Weeds, little boxes on a hillside, little boxes made out of ticky tacky. And you know, that song perfectly sums up Don't Worry Darling is that little boxes on a hillside, little boxes made out of ticky-tacky, little boxes on a hillside, and they all look just the same. And the people in the boxes all went to the universities where they were put in little boxes, and they all came out just the same. I hope you enjoy my singing. But that song was a satirical take on the suburbs and the boom of the suburbs between the 1940s and 60s. And it was a joke. It wasn't something to aspire to. It was something to mock and ridicule and make fun of and sort of condemn, because not only are the social constructs of American suburbs terrible, but suburbs in general are just terrible in terms of design and layout and accessibility. They are extremely car dependent. They are far removed from any city and urban core or, you know, urban resources. They, God forbid, it's a gated community in an urban, in a suburb. That's even worse. But suburbs are essentially alienating and dystopian in structure. And it only makes sense that a sort of, you know, post-feminist horror thriller film is set in the most dystopian thing on the planet Earth. And it's not Gilead, it's the American suburb. You know, Gilead exists in a lot of American suburbs. You don't have to go far to find evangelical housewives forced into a life that they do not want and probably have serious substance abuse problems. Take out the barbiturates to opiates and it's the same thing. In today's context, the archaic notion of a man working while his wife stays home is confined to the realms of traditional wife YouTubers and TikTokers and incelers. This particular aspect is intriguing as it could have been explored with more depth and subtlety. The revelation of a VR simulation as the film's conclusion feels overused, even though it's not really a thing anymore. It just feels like it's already overused. Like, I've already kind of was halfway expecting that through the course of this film. I was hoping for something else. It lacks the freshness needed to engage viewers. I think if it was something else, I think it was a little bit more nuanced or a little bit more cynical, it would have been interesting. In fact, I would much prefer a cynical ending than the sort of slight, upbeat, joyful ending that this film has, that she escapes the simulation. I would have greatly appreciated a more dark, foreboding, sort of nihilistic ending to this film, because I really do hate Hollywood happy endings, and this film borders on that. It doesn't fully go Hollywood happy ending, but it borders on it, which is my fundamental problem with it. Upon rewatching, I still feel a more compelling narrative could have situated the story in a bizarre post-apocalyptic society, perhaps still set in the 50s, but in a world that collapsed with victory representing a small remnant trying to hold on to the vestiges of the old ways. Like, I feel like if, for example, it was an alternate 50s where maybe a nuclear war did happen and this small segment of society was a control test to maybe rebuild society after the bombs fell in a post-apocalyptic 1950s America, and this was a controlled environment and, you know, there was really no escape because the area outside of it was a virtual radioactive wasteland and there was nowhere to go, that there was no out, that it was just victory left and that was the only vestiges of society. That to me is more dreadful. That to me is more nihilistic, because then the people rebuilding society are the least qualified. They're the last people you want to have their way in this world. They're the Jordan Petersons, the Joe Rogans, the Matt Walshers, the Ben Shapiros. Like, imagine being stuck in a company town in a post-apocalyptic world, and the only people you have left to rebuild society in whatever image they see fit are Mr. Vaginas Don't Get Wet, Ben Shapiro. That to me would be a fucking nightmare. Probably more than a virtual reality. At least in the virtual reality, she has the option to go back to her life and rebuild. There is some hope of escape from that, right? There is some hope of tomorrow doesn't have to be this way, that I can find a better way out from this nightmarish dystopian world that I'm in. But if that was the case where there is no escape, where victory is all that is left, then That to me is far more nihilistic, far more dreadful, far, far more hopeless than what we were left with at the end of this film. I feel like that would have been more interesting. I feel like that would have been a better take on this overall kind of story, because I'm a nihilist. I don't believe in happy endings in terms of film and cinema, because rarely do they feel deserved or warranted. Most of the time they just feel shoehorned in, and I do feel like that is kind of the case with Don't Worry, Darling. The fun fact about this film is, though, when I was at Capstone Pictures, which was one of my first jobs back in 2019, this was on our script reading list. I don't remember if I read it or not. I'm trying to remember if I originally read it. I would have loved it if I originally read it, but I found it funny because I was going through my old emails, and one of the names of the projects that we were reviewing at Capstone was Don't Worry, Darling, with Olivia Wilde attached. And I just thought that was hilarious that I have a tangential connection to this film, because it was probably something that was circulating in the blacklist, and we probably read it at Capstone, maybe before I arrived. But I do find that kind of hilarious that one of the films that I'm covering, I have a loose connection to. I also have a very, very tenuous connection to The Wolf of Wall Street, which I might cover in a later episode somewhere around down the line this season. But I do find it very funny. It's hilarious to me. But again, the fear with such an approach in the absence of an escape from the nightmarish reality, leaving no room for reform or any chance of reclaiming what was lost, it would simply be the desolate remains of a shattered world. An awareness so dreadfully horrific that I think such an ending would have alienated most audiences, but I feel like that ending would have made this a stronger movie. I feel like a hopeless, downtrodden, nihilistic ending was called for. My fundamental problem with this film is that there is an escape, and I don't feel like there should be, because the fact of the matter is, there really isn't escape for us in this world, right? We're never really going to solve the problems of men hating women. We're never going to make incels shut up now that they're a thing. We can pound their heads on the desk and try to talk sense into them in that, hey, you know, why would you want to alienate 50% of the world's population from the economy? That sounds like a dreadfully stupid fucking idea, but that's never going to make sense to them, because an evangelical or conservative mind only sees in binaries in black and white. It is, you know, men providers, women nurturers. That's it. That's all there is. There's nothing more to it. That's how society should be structured. Never mind the fact that such a society structured that way has never fucking existed, because guess what? Frontier women in the Old West kind of had to know how to shoot a rifle and how to know to stitch up clothing and how to cook. Men had to know to cook too and clean their clothes when they were out on the trails, because a woman wasn't there to do it. And it's also sort of that thing like, oh, okay, so a woman's role is to cook and clean and be in the kitchen, but if you have to depend on someone else for the basic necessities of your own existence, that doesn't make you an alpha male, right? I always find it funny that alpha dudes in the manosphere are like, men don't cook. And I'm just like, okay, then if you have to rely on someone else for the basic function of cooking, then I have news for you. You're not really an alpha, because an alpha, in theory, wouldn't rely on anyone else to do the things needed to maintain a basic functioning human existence. But again, we can have that discussion all we want. We can make the same points again and again and again and again and again, and nothing will get accomplished, because they simply do not see us as human beings. They simply do not think we are worthy of the same basic rights as every other human being. To the mansphere, women are essentially the other. We're aliens, we're property, we're livestock, we're nothing more than just breeding factories. I can't have a child, unfortunately, as much as I would really love to. That's probably what I'm going to cover in Rosemary's Baby. But, you know, the fact of the matter is, most women are seen that way. And that's why I feel like an ending where there is no escape from that reality is more in line of just our daily existence. Because as a woman, there really is no escape from this reality where we have to deal with men like Jack and like Frank on a daily fucking basis. The reason why girls have to grow up quicker in this world is because early on, girls learn men look at them different. And usually that happens around the ages of between 11 to 13, 10 if you're really unlucky. But it isn't unheard of that a girl already has a strange experience with a man, sometimes even a family member, between the ages of 10 and 13. So women, essentially, we lose our innocence a lot earlier in life than men do. We aren't allowed to be girls for too long. We are forced to grow up quicker. We are, you know, for better or worse, I think it's for better because I don't think these are necessarily gendered requirements. I think they're just basic skills to have for a functioning existence. But we are taught to clean our clothes, cook dinner, clean the house, wash dishes, sew, which I learned how to sew and then I forgot how to do it because I hardly ever do it. I do want to learn how to sew again because that would save me so much money on clothing alterations. But we are taught all of those skills, whereas boys aren't necessarily. Boys aren't taught those skills as early as girls are. Girls are taught those skills pretty early on in our lives. We're taught how to cook. We're taught how to clean. We're taught how to cook. I loved baking. That's my sort of go-to. I love making cookies. So sue me. I'm a bit trad wifey sometimes when I want to be. But the caveat to that is I choose to be trad wifey when I want to be. If I want to make you a dinner, it is going to be a fucking phenomenal dinner with wine, with music, with everything. The whole 10 yards, right? But I choose when I want to do that. And it's only once every now and then. It is not every night. Because if I had to do that every night, I would be murdering someone after the end of the third course. But the fact of the matter is, I choose when I want to do that. And that seems to be the constant thing I want to reiterate is, it's perfectly fine so long as it's your choice, right? It is your choice to do these things or not do these things. That is an ideal situation to be in if you have a choice. But having said that, the one thing most women do not have a choice in, regardless of our social economic status, regardless of our sexual orientation, regardless of even of our AGAB, right? It is assigned gender at birth. So basically, this is something that I think cis women and trans women can probably agree on and probably have all experienced. Obviously, cis women experience it a lot earlier than trans women. But that is disgusting, creepy, weird, hostile, cruel, and alienating men. And male chauvinism and sexism is male chauvinism and sexism, irregardless if it's aimed at a cis or trans woman. With trans women, there is a bit more violence, obviously, towards it. There is such a thing as trans chauvinism and trans sexism. But it's still an aspect of life that for any female identifying individual is something that we cannot escape. It is a facet we are either born into or we have to come to terms with and simply accept as a fact that that is going to be our existence from here on out, and there is no escape from it. Again, Gilead exists for a lot of women in this country, and we do not need another book from Margaret Atwood to say how horrible a world like Gilead would be. It's here, it's now, it exists. Victory is here, it's now, it exists for a lot of women in this country, especially if you're within conservative alt-right circles or if you're in the evangelical community. Victory is your life, and there is no escape from that. And if you do escape, it is hard, it is painful, and even when you do escape that environment, guess what? You're just confronted with more male chauvinism and sexism in your daily existence, and there's no escape from that. So that is sort of why I think this film would work better with a more downtrodden ending, would work better with a more cynical sort of approach, because there is just no escape for us. And implying that there can be an escape is kind of a cop-out because, you know, sort of the idea being is that she can escape, but we can't. When she leaves Victory, you, the audience member, the woman in the audience, when you walk out of the movie theater, you're entering victory because you're still faced with the day-to-day horrors of male sexism, of society pulling you every which way, of telling you, you have to be a housewife, you have to have babies. No, you fucking don't. I would like to have a kid, but that's my choice. I know plenty of women that don't want to have a child, and that's perfectly fine because it's their choice. Not everyone wants to have a kid. Not everyone wants to be a parent. Not everyone wants to raise a little bastard in this world or even wants to bring in a kid into this dreadfully horrific world, and that's perfectly understandable. I feel like maybe bringing in a kid in this world would probably, you know, I would like to make them stronger and carry on my family legacy and carry on my legacy. Is that a selfish motivation? Sure. Yes, I would agree. But again, it's my choice. And if there's one thing I want to leave you with, it is that the ideal situation for any true feminist is that everything is fine so long as your choice as an individual, so long as you still have agency as a person to choose what you want to do with your life, then that is okay. If your agency is stolen from you, as in ripped and robbed and stolen, just like it was Alice in the film, then that's where the line is drawn. Everything is okay up until the decimation of free will and individual agency. That is where I would say that is an issue. And if you want to be a housewife, feel free to be a housewife. You shouldn't have to feel forced to be a housewife. That's the thing. If you want to have kids, have kids. You shouldn't have to feel forced to have kids. That's the thing. And unfortunately, we are kind of coerced or talked into or forced or just expected to have babies. And that is not where it's okay. That is where I draw the line. So that's sort of my thoughts on Don't Worry, Darling. I hope you enjoy it. But so concludes today's episode on this very odd and clunky film, both a product of its time and also probably one that will be looked back upon in the next few years as a cult gem, because I do think there are aspects of it that are kind of going to resonate for a couple more years that might have audiences look like. I can imagine this in a film feminist course in the next 10 years, which would probably be taught by me, of course, because I'm trying to study to get my master's so I can be a film professor. So that way I can take my podcasts and do them in real life and be a wonderful professor. You can have your kids come and talk to me. They will learn all the glories and wonders of cinema from a very disgruntled, cynical film professor that's probably been doing it for way too long with wonderful gray hair and a few wrinkles around her face, but hopefully I age like wine. But, you know, I do think this is going to be a cult gem in a decade or so. And I can foresee that being the longevity of this film, because there are a lot of aspects that I can see audiences gravitating towards in the next few years as we just have to deal with incels and guys like Jordan Peterson who won't shut the fuck up. But yeah, I do think this is going to be a hidden gem in the next couple of decades. But join us next week as we take a look at Guillermo del Toro's 2001 classic, the spiritual prequel to Pan's Labyrinth, his 2001 Spanish horror children's fairy tale, The Devil's Backbone, in a belated homage to Dios de los Muertos, Day of the Dead. This has been your host, Aaron Escobar. I hope you enjoyed my ramblings for the last 45 minutes to an hour. Signing off.
Can't you see?